always said I looked good in a tuxedo.
You do.
Then this is the way I want you to remember me.
I'll never forget you.
Fine, Maurice.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge, I can see he's smiling already.
This is Tyler Orton, checking to see how far these spots really go down.
Okay, well that's relevant, because this week we are going to talk about the Deep Space Nine finale, What We Leave Behind.
No, what you leave behind. But, I guess...
Didn't we all leave DS9 behind, though?
We did leave DS9 behind, so I think you're just... taking it for more of that kind of communal sort
of community-based
experience.
Yeah, we all left it behind. Also, that documentary is a really similar name that's confusing me at the moment.
What We Left Behind.
Of course, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Fair enough. But, Cam, this is a fascinating one to tackle, because I think this is such a weird finale for Star Trek.
Right.
Less weird
than
Turnabout
Intruder.
Intruder, you know?
Or Counterclock Incident.
Yeah, but I note this because, you know, before we decided that we were going to do this episode, I wanted to watch the final chapter from Deep Space Nine, those preceding 8 hours before we got to the finale. And I'm not going to talk about those, really. I might touch upon them
by accident. You watched them then.
I wanted to watch them to kind of see, like, it would have been weird for me to just like hop into this finale
right
with so many of the reference points kind of missing in my brain, because it's been a couple years since I watched, you know, DS9 all the way through.
It's sort of like watching the two-parter in the like 7-episode Dominion Invasion arc.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Just being dropped into there, you would have been like, huh, I bet there's a lot of nuances that I'm not picking up here. So I'm not going to focus on the final chapter, you know, forgive me if I make reference to it, but it was a fascinating experience in that I saw them creating a lot of, say, story threads that they did have to tie up within the finale. And it wasn't
right.
necessarily just kind of the mythology of the series overall, but the mythology created within the preceding 8 hours, which I thought was interesting. But here we want to focus on, I think, what does this really mean in terms of how finales go for Star Trek? Where does this stack up? I think the litmus test for a lot of people is obviously going to be All Good Things.
I thought you were going to say Turnabout Intruder, but
well,
okay.
Well, you know, next time it will be.
Yeah.
When we go to the Star Trek Voyager Endgame, then the litmus test will be Turnabout, of course. Yeah. So what we really want to answer here is how does this work as a finale, not just like a feature-length episode, but how does this work tying up all the threads, both in terms of story as well as characters? And I think you and I, we came into this going like, hey man, how the heck are we going to like tackle this one? Because it is a beast.
Right.
And I guess the best way we came up with is we're going to tackle first like story and then talk about where the characters end up and how that kind of closure could work for possible other adventures we could imagine them being in.
And maybe how it works as like a bookend to where they started in Emissary.
You know what? Maybe I should have added Emissary onto the list of episodes that
spent
watching.
When you look at, you know, All Good Things, it's such a like bookend to the Encounter at Farpoint with the whole Q stuff.
Very
and the
literally.
Robes.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to look at this one being the next finale after TNG's gone off the air and how it does sort of work as a bookend for a series.
There was a baseball reference, I'll say that much.
There was.
So why don't we just kind of jump into it with regards to storylines? I think there's a couple big storylines we want to do. And let's talk about the resolution to the Dominion War here,
right,
where we spend, the first, you know, hour plus.
Yeah,
like,
it's about an hour and 8 minutes, I believe.
So you timed it out, okay.
I did, yeah.
And look, I think this is a long time coming, but it's kind of weird because Voyager was very much a destination-based television series. Like their goal was to get to the end and get back to
there
the
was
Alpha
an
Quadrant.
Ending built into Voyager.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not necessarily when, you know, Emissary premiered with
right.
Deep Space Nine, but I think by the time you realize that the Dominion War is not going to be swept under the rug after that 6-episode arc at the beginning of season 6, then you realize it's almost becoming a bit of a destination. I think we all kind of suspected as watchers that it was not going to end with the downfall of the Federation.
How do you think someone watching Emissary would have thought the series would end.
You know what? Okay, that's so fascinating, because at that point, Next Generation had not even ended yet.
Yeah.
And so, and I think a lot of people tuning in for Emissary, they're like, okay, so you've set up the universe.
Right.
Where do you go from here? Because it's not like a ship visiting planet to planet or right. having an adventure of the week the way that you typically would. How would those first-time viewers suspect that it would end? I don't know, Cam. I'll throw it to you. Did you have any idea when you watched it a couple years ago?
I feel like you would have seen Bajor enter the Federation.
Yeah.
And maybe Sisko resolving his whole relationship with the Prophets.
See, I wouldn't have suspected that, because to me, the whole Prophet relationship kind of seemed like a one-off adventure in that first episode, where like the Prophets... Right. I didn't feel
that... You really thought they were going to go away, though, after Emissary? Well, if that was the only episode you'd ever seen?
I never thought they would become so prominent within the mythology of the series, though. Yeah. At no point. Right. Like, I thought there would maybe be, like, once a season, they mentioned the Prophets in, like, a Bajoran-centric episode.
You would have thought maybe Kyo Paka was going to be the big star of the series?
that was my next guess there. But think about it, because, like, it's also... Like, Sisko didn't really embrace, and the series didn't really embrace his role as Emissary, I think, not until really season 5.
Right.
Yeah. They would say it in passing. Oh, yeah, he's the Emissary. Mm-hmm. It didn't really mean that much, though, I think, until season 5, though.
Right.
And so, no, I wouldn't have necessarily suspected we'd get, like, this big payoff for mm-hmm. the Prophets, though. So, let's swing back to maybe the resolution of this series with regards to the Dominion War specifically, because I think maybe we can get into the Prophet stuff in just a few moments, too.
Yeah.
But I wonder if one of my criticisms of the finale is that it was a little bit too story beat by story beats, I guess, centric.
Right.
You know, like, I wonder if they were a little bit too beholden to kind of tying things up a little bit too perfectly, where I kind of get the sense wars take a long time to resolve.
Yeah.
And very much like our criticisms of the finale of Star Trek Discovery Season 1,
yeah.
this war wrapped up fairly quickly.
Although it's somehow easier to forgive because the Discovery one was so abrupt.
Yeah.
This one you're like, well, that seems well done.
We did get to view it take place over the course of 2 seasons. Yeah. And I think the very important thing here is the turn came with regards to the Cardassians saying, wait a minute, you can't obliterate our entire civilian population.
Right.
I don't exactly know what the Dominion was thinking by giving that order. I don't know. But how did you come away with regards to the Dominion side of the storyline?
Right. I mean, DS9 was always at a disadvantage with this grand war story in that this is very much a war waged by small groups of people in a room.
Sure.
You know, and so it does kind of limit the scale of what they're talking about. You know, they keep talking about these bombing of cities. You don't really see anything. And to me, it does feel small where it's like, okay, we've got to storm the compound and catch the female changeling and all that. And it's like, you know, what, like 5 security guards?
Sure. But
it does feel small. Like, it feels like a very small kind of event. And it also feels incredibly convenient way to wrap up this war.
Yeah.
Which, leading up to this, has been really complicated. Now, I really enjoy this finale, so I don't want to sound like I'm bagging on it. But in terms of how it's executed, it does feel very like... This is 1990s syndicated TV.
Yeah, and I totally get that. And I think I was very forgiving of it because I knew intellectually it was 1990s syndicated TV. And honestly, the first time I watched this, you know, back in the 1990s, mm-hmm. I could watch these, you know, really phenomenal, like, ship-to-ship combat sequences.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great sequence when they're busting through the defenses.
And it still holds up to this day.
Yeah, it does. It looks great. It looks better than the Discovery space battles.
And we've talked about that, and we still don't have a satisfactory answer as to why the VFX on Voyager and Deep Space Nine look superior to what we see on Star Trek Discovery 25 years later.
Yeah, no kidding.
But, I digress a tad bit. But, I mean, for the Dominion stuff, I feel you when you say, yeah, maybe the compound stuff felt a little small, but maybe there's some of those character beats where they're saying, well, why don't we go knock on the door and ask if we can come in? You know, like where they're actually...
It's kind of that exhausted breakdown sequence. Yeah. You know? Which you see in a lot of war movies where people start laughing over things that aren't really that funny, but it's because they're in such a terrible, terrible situation. Any sort of release is cathartic.
It's like, what else can they do?
Exactly, exactly. So I really like this moment. I think it works incredibly well.
Yeah.
And I think for me, a lot of the time, the least interesting part of the buildup, not just in this finale, but also in just the final chapter, was the Kira, Garrick, and Damar kind of sitting around in a basement. We hear a lot of talk.
In Star Trek?
I know. About how Damar is just sweeping the nation.
Yeah.
But there's very little like visual evidence of it, you know. And look, they had what they had to work with in terms of their budget. I would have liked to have seen a little more forgiving
of this, because I know
I'm forgiving of it. Yeah. I intellectually understand why it's not there, but I'm saying, like, it does kind of inhibit to me a little bit of that feeling of sort of the importance of Damar, where it's just characters kind of referencing it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I would have liked to have seen something a little more with it, but it's fine.
Well, we did see, like, people recognizing him in the streets, you know?
Four people.
Yeah. I don't know. To me, it's kind of like, I can't judge it for what it's not, but what it is trying to accomplish, based on, like, the, I guess, limits.
Yes, it's incredibly ambitious.
Budget had.
Yeah, it's so ambitious for what they had, you know, budget-wise and all that sort of thing. So, like, I'm not, like, trying to say, like, I don't like it for this reason.
Beyond the production values, though, like, let's talk a little bit about maybe kind of the wrap-up to the civilian sort of resistance that's going on. I'm actually kind of satisfied with this, in that I think it would have felt pretty lame if the war ends because the Federation Alliance just sweeps in, shoots a whole bunch of ships, and announce, we've now won this war.
Right. It's also just a really cool echo of the Bajoran people rising up against the Cardassians. This time it's the Cardassians rising up and driving the Dominion out.
And they make note of that. Like, where isn't it ironic that this former Bajoran terrorist / freedom fighter is the one who's helping liberate Cardassia?
You wouldn't have guessed that from the emissary.
No, not at all. And so, look, I'm very satisfied with what I think the resolution is to the war, and that the Cardassians were very slow to kind of realize the error of their ways, but I think the Cardassians are actually kind of a bit of a dirtbag sort of species, in that, like, wait a minute, war is bad now because now it's affecting us to a degree that we never expected, you know. And it's just like, okay, I get what your motivation is at this point,
right?
Would never align with you in the future. Mm-hmm. But there you go. But to me, it wouldn't have worked without kind of the civilian uprising.
Right. No, I agree.
As well. Yeah. Other storylines. Well, let's get into the Bajoran prophet stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that this was the weakest part of the finale, and that we are watching these exciting action sequences that have some very wonderful character moments throughout the Defiant Bridge, where I think what they're all the back and forth going on throughout the Bridge of the Defiant.
Great stuff.
It's so fantastic. Where you're talking about, like, Julian and Miles, their own relationship, Worf and Ezri, and the future of the Ezri-Julian relationship. It's just fascinating moments between all of this.
And, you know, we'll get to character stuff later, but it's brilliant, I think, in this finale to set it up in that the early scenes are just the characters hanging out in their various relationships.
Yeah.
And so you get that, you know, even though we've followed these characters for 7 seasons, you still are kind of that reminder of what's at stake, who these people are, why their lives matter, and then you hurl them into this war, and they're still carrying on these relationship moments in kind of the pitch of battle. And to me, that's just a great, great device to use, because you keep flashing back to, you know, these earlier scenes, as well as just feeling the weight of this war. And because of, you know, the limit of what they can achieve visually, you still carry the emotion of it so strongly because all that ground is laid so well.
Yeah, but Kim, we keep cutting to scenes of Wynn and Dukat on a hike.
Boy. Yeah.
And it wasn't just like one scene or two scenes.
Okay.
We kept going back to them on this long hike through the fire caves. And I was just like, oh, good God, I don't want to be here. Like, I think it was a failure of editing, in that I think it could have worked had they...
How many days are they in those fire caves?
That's the other thing. I was like, how long have they been in these effing fire caves?
Kai Wynn is like reciting passages for what must be over a day and a half.
And, well, the other thing is, like, Dukat had a great line. It's like, do you have to rest so often? Is that why it took so long? Is because Kai Wynn just had to keep catching her breath?
The best line in the entire finale comes from Kai Wynn when she says, I feel like a young woman waiting for my lover to sweep me away.
In reference to the Paul race, I assume. Yeah. Not necessarily Gul Dukat. Yeah.
Now, I just had to
think... How many lovers did the Kai have? I am curious.
I don't want to know.
Okay.
But I just have to think of Ira Stephen Bear sitting at his typewriter, writing that line, being like, gold.
I like
how... Nailed it.
Yeah.
I'm done for the day.
Would this have worked for you had they kind of shoved all of these sequences to closer to the Vic Fontaine sequence in the last half of the finale?
Oh, in the last half.
Yeah, instead
I wonder if it would have felt like it's coming out of nowhere. Like, I feel like just there's something fundamentally broken with this entire subplot.
Yeah.
And that I don't know how you work it in organically. I know that originally, like, Rick Berman, one of his big edicts for this finale was, it better not be entirely a Dominion War story.
Okay.
There better be more to it. And they agreed. They were like, yeah, we're going to tie up all this other stuff so you get the Coast of Mojin and all that. But just the scale of what the Coast Mojin story is, like what Dukat and Wynn are doing over the course of the story, is so small in terms of the amount of time it's unfolding over.
Yes.
That you cannot spread this over this finale of a war, because it feels like they're literally in a cave for like 5 days. It just doesn't work. And, you know, a small note that like annoyed me was early on, Dukat comes into the Kai's office and she's like, oh, you can see again. And he's like, oh, yeah, the Paw Race forgave me. And I'm like, you know, that is one of the best moments in the, you know, a couple episodes earlier where he's blinded and she's like, you're like a beggar on the streets now. Yeah. And to me, that was such a like brutal thing to happen to Dukat. I would have liked to have just kept that, and kept him blind.
Brushed
maybe,
over.
Yeah, and just have him dragged into the cave, maybe blind, and he gains a sight back when he's transformed. I felt that, like that would have been at least a more interesting payoff.
Or even at least like maybe an episode or two before, like what about just a subplot with Dukat on the streets or something?
Yeah.
Like, that would have been, but instead those two characters actually disappeared for a number of episodes because the writers admitted they didn't really know what to do with their storyline anymore.
Yeah.
And I feel as if they didn't quite know what to do with the storyline after they brought them back either.
You know, the whole taking of Cardassia, that happens, and then them coming back to DS9, having this whole celebration. In that period, it cuts between Kai Wynn, like, starting her reciting of the lines of the Coast of Mojin to continuing reciting lines.
Like, the only way that I can justify it or rationalize it in my own head is that while we're watching it intercut with the Dominion War finale, the scenes actually took place well after Cardassia fell.
Sure. Like, it's not totally chronological.
But which is why I think it just would have worked better for me as a viewer if they just kind of mashed all the scene. Look, you have scene number one with Dukat entering the office, you cut to all the Dominion War stuff, and you don't return to it again until after the Dominion War has concluded, and then they're in the fire case.
Right.
I think that just would have been the best way to handle that. But
I agree.
You know, and then overall, I think we'll touch on this more with regards to the characters, but Sisko's role in this. Are you satisfied with the role that he plays in the Bajoran aspect of the finale?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think, you know, Sisko's ultimate fate in this story of tackling Dukat and going into the, you know, the fire, I think it works.
To me, it makes sense.
Yeah, it makes total sense.
As much as I do have issues with the Dukat and Wynn stuff,
yeah,
Sisko's role in it works for me. It
seems,
you know, poetic. It seems as if this is what they've been building to for a long, long time. And it just would have felt weird if, I mean, all we got was, you know, hey, I'm now Admiral Sisko.
Right.
You know, that was kind of the fate of the character there. I think this is far more in keeping with the themes of Deep Space Nine.
I agree 100%. I think it works story-wise. Execution-wise, it's troubling.
In that he literally jumps into a pit of fire?
But even just kind of before that, where they're at the party and he's just like, oh, gotta go. And he gets there. Do you know how long he deals with them? It's under 4 minutes.
Okay. Yeah.
It's like he gets there, scuffles, goes in the fire, the end. And you're like, wow, that is super abrupt.
I'm still fascinated because it's about a 3-hour runabout ride.
Yeah.
Because I'm assuming he's not going at warp speed.
Sure.
And
he's taking his time.
Well, and that's the other thing. Like, okay, how long did it take Dukat and Wynn to get through the fire caves?
Right.
It took Sisko. Did he just beam right through, like, mountains?
If it were a movie, you would feel like they'd edited out a lot of footage just to get to the point.
I'm fine with that, though.
Yeah. You know? But it does feel very much like Sisko teleporting there.
Yeah. You know, well, they do literally have transporters in Star Trek, but
yeah, they should have just used that, like come up with a way to just do that to make it more convincing.
But then why didn't Dukat and Wynn use the transporter? I don't know. It's just, okay. So this is how the storyline is resolved for the Bajoran stuff. I was never a huge fan of all the Bajoran politics and Bajoran religion aspect of the series. I think they wrapped it up as well as they could for a viewer like me.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel as if there's just some element missing critically. And by the time that Dukat suddenly has magic telepathy powers.
He turns into like Highlander or something.
Yeah, and I'm just kind of like, okay, Professor X.
He needed like a really scary voice on top of it.
Like from Ghostbusters?
Yeah.
Like Rick Moranis?
Make it sound like his voice is coming through a megaphone.
Okay, yeah. Like, he's got the red eyeballs.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, look, we get it. He's evil, and, you know, the emissary is good.
Like, right.
It's very on the nose, but sure. I'm okay with that. I think the...
Kaiwin is dust.
Yeah, well, what do you feel about Kaiwin eventually coming around saying, hey, wait a minute, no, I don't want to, you know, follow the path of the Paw Wraiths now. Hey, emissary, yeah. You need to destroy the book.
I mean, again, it makes sense on paper that this character would have this transition, but again, executed over 3.5 minutes, it's really, really rapid.
What do you think about the very fact that so much of this comes down to a magic book?
That's my favorite device.
Is it?
Magic books.
Yeah.
You can't beat a good magic book in a movie. No, I mean, yeah.
This is kind of weak to me. You know, it's to me, it's Star Trek. The reason the prophets actually, I think, work in concept is because these are aliens.
Right.
But that aliens that are worshipped, which is a very common theme
sure.
throughout Star Trek. But when you get into kind of the magic book stuff, I'm like, well, we're getting away from the sci-fi element and more into the fantasy element. And
right.
if really the resolution is incinerating a magic book.
Yeah.
And then I'm just like, huh. Okay.
Well, when you look at the prophets, like, we have a relationship with the prophets, and the characters do too. You know, Sisko spends a lot of time talking to the prophets over the course of that series. Whereas, like, the Paw Wraiths, yeah, they just kind of feel like mystical evildoers.
Yeah.
And they're just like, not interesting.
What is their motivation, I suppose?
Evil.
Yeah.
It turns into a very simple binary good versus evil thing. Whereas, like, I always felt like the prophets were a little more ambiguous.
Well, and yeah, just because their conception of time and all that was very different. And I guess Paw Wraiths had been expelled from the Celestial Temple.
Right.
I don't know. It just kind of, it felt hard for me to invest in the Paw Wraith storyline.
It's the sort of thing that if they want to do the Paw Wraiths, they should have started a lot earlier.
Yeah. Well, wasn't it season 4, though?
Is it that early?
I think it was that was the first reference, because remember Keiko came back, and
right.
I think this is the episode, The Assignment.
Okay.
And Keiko came back from Bajor, and she was the one who had, back then it was called the Costa Moran, not
right.
the Costa Mojin, and they changed the name because they didn't want people to call it the Costa Moron.
Oh, okay.
So that's kind of funny, yeah.
That is pretty good.
But I think it was season 4.
Is it? Okay, okay.
Yeah, but the thing is, they didn't really get into the Paw Wraiths until season 6 when Dukat, he had disappeared after Waltz. And
right,
then he reappeared once again as the cult's leader.
Yeah, they never really folded them into the overall ongoing mythology of the show in an interesting way until you get to, and they never really did in an interesting way, but it seemed like they really kind of doubled down on that stuff when you get into the later seasons, and it's almost like they should have set something up earlier so that at least the audience has a relationship with this. It doesn't feel like, as you know, you referenced earlier, like Ghostbusters.
No.
Because there's that episode, The Reckoning, where it feels like Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
And when you get to this stuff, it felt to me like Temple of Doom, you know?
I agree. I really wanted a scene where they're on the tracks with the mining carts and, you know.
Or they're like lowering like Nog into the fire. After removing his heart.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think the other storyline, speaking of gods, would be, I guess, ultimately the founders. Because part of the resolution is that Odo beams down, talks to the female changeling,
mm-hmm.
and he convinces her to link, and all of a sudden, she kind of turns. She's like, okay, I agree to this. First time I watched this, I was actually quite unsatisfied with the resolution here. But
oh, interesting.
The most recent time that I watched it, I actually was satisfied. It actually did make sense to me in that Odo lays out his argument.
Mm-hmm.
The female changeling lays out her argument. Mm-hmm. I understand both sides, and it seems in keeping with them to link, and they understand each other in a way that, you know, we just couldn't
right.
wrap our heads around. I'm actually satisfied with where we end up with the founders eventually, that she says, you know what, I'm going to pay for my crimes. I agree to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be up to Odo to go provide the cure to the rest of the founders.
Right.
And presumably, he's also, like, very much like he did with the female changeling, he's going to teach the rest of the Great Link the error of their ways, so
sure.
to speak. Yeah.
Well, and you see with the female changeling in that, like, all hope is lost. Like, the, you know, all the founders are going to be wiped out by this disease. And so, you know, there's the point where they're like, well, what's the point? We've lost. And she's like, doesn't matter. We're going to take out as many as we can.
Yeah.
And it's because there's just nothing left. She's gone pure nihilism. And ultimately, it's Odo coming in and showing her, no, I can save our people, but you have to turn yourself in. That's what motivates the decision. Because leading up to that, she's willing to go down in just, you know, as sadistic a way as possible because, like, what does it matter?
Well, and remember, she even says, like, she can handle her own destruction. What tortures her right now is knowing that the rest of her people are dying and there's nothing she can do about it. So it totally makes sense to me, especially watching it this time around. So,
well, a lot of this arc kind of feels like people finding meaning in just the worst of circumstances, where you have Sisko discovering kind of the meaning of his journey and Odo, where he's going, and Kira, and then even the female changeling realizing, like, okay, like, this is where this needs to go. This whole brutal war, which they have lost, out of failure will be the one redeeming hope for my people.
Mm-hmm.
So it does kind of give all the characters kind of what they kind of are yearning for, in a weird way.
Yeah.
Except for Martok, who doesn't have drinking buddies.
That was a kind of sad scene, but we can get into that in a few moments. Yeah. One critique that I do have, is that there wasn't really a station-based storyline going on throughout that. And I think that the station itself, the titular element of the series, it was somewhat ill-served by the finale. In that
we actually, I think,
spent more time at Vix than we did just, you know, being out and about on the promenade or in ops or, you know, so on and so forth. But I don't know how they would have crammed in yet another storyline that centered on the station.
Yeah, unless you're throwing Jake something to do, maybe. But yeah. I don't even know what he's doing.
He could have been playing Go Fish with Quark and Vic.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. There's not a lot to do on the station.
Yeah. Are there any overarching storylines that we haven't touched upon that you think we should at least, you know, talk about briefly before we get into the characters, which I think the character elements is really what we want to discuss even more. It's kind of the bread and butter, I think, of today's episode.
Well, I mean, do you think Quark should have had some sort of story? Because he is such an important character to this series, and he is kind of stranded in this finale. He has some nice moments, but he is kind of stranded by the story.
I wrestled with this a lot, and ultimately I think no.
Yeah.
In that, like, Quark was a very integral character to this series, but not to the mythology of Deep Space Nine. And I think more so than any other series, this is a franchise about mythology.
Right.
I think the next closest one where they really built a mythology, though, is Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And Quark's part in the mythology wasn't integral. I think even Jake played more of a role within the mythology of Deep Space Nine than Quark did. But
he does get the final shot as well, you know, of Jake.
Yeah.
So.
And but Quark does get the final line of the series.
It's true.
And one of my favorite lines of all time, which I think we can all take with us, but the more things change, the more they stay the same.
This was the only time in a live-action Star Trek that the final line of the series wasn't spoken by a captain.
Oh, okay.
With, you know, the animated series is an asterisk, but the final line was spoken by Robert April's wife. I think that one actually may be better than the Quark just because it's a lot funnier.
Fair enough. Yeah.
That's a little trivia note. But no, it's interesting that Quark is the one to sign off the series. And that, I mean, it makes sense because when you look at Deep Space Nine, Quark's the constant. He's always going to be there.
Yeah.
These other characters are going to come and go. I mean, Kira's there at the end of the series, but she'll probably leave at some point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all these characters are going to leave, but Quark will probably be there for good.
Yeah. And look, I'm okay because I think somehow inserting him into the mythology of the series would have felt disingenuous.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the fact that Quark is the constant throughout this, and I'll briefly reference the final chapter, but, you know, he had his moments throughout the final chapter.
Friday the 13th 4?
Okay. took me a beat.
I didn't know Quark was in that.
Yeah, thanks, Jason.
Yeah.
You know, he had his moments there at the final chapter. He only got one centric episode, which was the previous one, Dogs of War.
Right, yeah.
And it just would have been weird had they just made him, you know, a big part of the reason why the Dominion gave up, or he comes to the rescue at the very last moment. I think that was, you know, the best part of that was actually in the Sacrifice of Angels finale, where he goes and saves Rom from execution at the very last moment. But I think that would have just felt like a retread had they done that again somehow within this finale. So I'm okay that Quark wasn't necessarily front and center. It just felt more in keeping with the themes of the finale.
Right. And it did allow Quark to kind of have these scenes with Vic Fontaine where you are getting sort of a resolution to the Vic Fontaine character, because if it's tough to work Quark into a Dominion War wrap-up story, I mean, Vic Fontaine, there's no purpose for him to be there.
Yeah.
And so it does kind of allow us to kind of say goodbye to that character as well.
So I think why don't we dive into the characters, and I think you and I discussed, you know, maybe we need to divide them up into character groups and discuss this, but let's briefly kind of talk a little bit about what they did on All Good Things, where that is a Picard-centric episode.
Yeah.
You know, like, do you feel as if, you know, you watch Riker and All Good Things, and you're like, oh, he's getting his big finale resolution moment. It feels like just kind of another Riker week, you know, like another week in Riker's life.
Yeah.
This, not so much. I mean, I think if we take a look at where the characters find themselves throughout the finale and where they leave themselves, or what we leave behind, Cam, as you would say, then there actually sets up kind of maybe the continuation of this mythology that I was referencing here. So why don't we start with the Sisko Yates family here with Benjamin, Cassidy, and Jake. Of course, Cassidy is pregnant. She's suffering from a severe morning sickness. And at the end of the series, Sisko departs into the fire caves, but he does reappear and says, look, Cass, I will be back. I want you to know that. I know the child's on the way, but I will be back. And Avery Brooks specifically spoke to Iris Stephen Bear about this moment, because he said, like, as a man of color in America, it is very important to me that we have these intact family units where you can rest assured that the father figure will be a persistent figure within this person's life.
Yeah. And originally, too, they were going to kill Sisko in the Battle of Cardassia and then have him resurrected to battle Dukat. Which would have been, I think, a little bit much.
Yeah. How do you feel about, ultimately, I guess, the final moments between Cassidy and Benjamin?
Oh, I was thinking off the top of the episode, I kind of like the part where she's saying, you know, are you going to be okay? He's like, oh, I promise I'll be back. You know, I promise that I'll be around. And we see that promise broken by the end of the episode.
Yeah.
And so I really love that moment where it's him and Cassidy together. And I think one of the best, you know, it's interesting when you read a lot of the cast's response to this finale, they all talk about how emotional an episode it is and how it pays off all the big emotional moments. I think it does that far better than it does the story. I think when I look at this finale and what I love about it, it's the emotional moments. And there is a great moment at the end where they are in that, you know, the celestial temple. And, like, Sisko saying, I may be back in a year. And she, like, gasps. And
or
is
I might
like,
be back yesterday.
Yeah. Penny Johnson has this, like, response to it of just, like, she can't, like, bear that. And then he says, or yesterday. And it's, like, just a beautiful little moment because, you know, I suspect this was largely improv'd. I don't think she was maybe directed to respond this way.
Okay.
I don't know. Like, it just feels to me so off the cuff. You know, it doesn't feel like something that would be so specifically stated in the script.
Mm-hmm.
But even if it is in the script, like, it's a really beautiful moment. And then, you know, there is that hope that, you know, he will be back soon. I like that he never says, I may be back in a decade, maybe five decades, or yesterday. It's like 1 year or yesterday.
But it's
a
also,
small amount of time.
It's also to the benefit of the fans.
Yes.
Because Iris Stephen Bear also said, look, the captains are gods to the fans. Let's make this a very literal thing, you know,
right,
with regards to Sisko, which I thought was kind of a funny thing. But it's in fitting with the character's overall journey. To me, this was one of the most emotional moments from the entire finale. It's one of the final moments, too. And it's a tough thing because, look, the prophets came to Ben and they're like, hey, if you get married, you got a very painful time ahead of you here.
Yeah.
And he was willing to make that sacrifice, I suppose. The question that remains to me, in what form does Benjamin return?
Right.
Is he corporeal? Like, is he flesh and bone?
It's like a space ghost.
Yeah.
Like, I'm back.
Well, he's literally incinerated. Do the prophets have the ability to rematerialize his atoms? Or I don't, like, to me, it's kind of
what's the biggest miracle we've seen them work on the show?
I would say they stopped the Dominion invasion. With the wormhole.
Right.
And they made those ships disappear.
Right.
I would hope that they didn't obliterate all those ships, you know, just, you know, life, whether it's Jem'Hadar or, you know, Forta, it's still a value.
They're in, like, the time trap from the animated episode.
Very possible, yeah. And they're also animated suddenly. The prophets have the ability to animate people. Yeah.
That would be incredible.
It'd be great if we just got a one-off animated episode of Short Deep Space Nine. Yeah, a short track. Yeah. So, look, if they can dematerialize entire ships and crews, perhaps they can rematerialize one captain.
They rematerialize them in the fire.
Oops.
Yeah. Sorry. Well, I mean, they could, I guess, if they rematerialize them, it would just be in the, because the fires are gone. So would he just be at like the floor of the cave?
He has to climb up and then he falls.
Like, it's like Tom Cruise at the in Mission Impossible 2.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, that's an excellent question.
I've never really
thought too much about that because I was like, oh, I'm sure they could do it. I'm curious, though, in your mind, when you were watching this episode, maybe even the first time, how long did you think Sisko would be away? Did you think he'd be back in a year? Or did you have more of a sense of like...
I get the sense that he's gone for a while.
I know. That's how I've always felt.
Like,
even though he says yesterday or, you know, in a year, in my mind, I'm like, it's going to be a long, long,
long time. I'm thinking more like 20 years.
Yeah.
You know? So...
I know he says it's not linear time, but it is for her.
Exactly.
So, and Jake, and yeah.
Which is a tough, you know, road to travel for that family. Why don't we talk about Jake? In that, you brought it up a second ago. The last shot is Jake and Kira.
Yeah.
Jake staring wistfully towards the wormhole where his father, he knows his father is right now.
Right.
And I think this is a very important moment. Just think of an episode like The Visitor, which they did a flashback to during that very, very emotional montage that took place at the end of the episode.
Yeah.
Maybe the room got a little dusty as I watched it.
You cried over the death of Gowron all over again. We'll get to that later.
It literally gutted me.
Yeah.
And him. But I think that was such a powerful moment for Jake. And Jake, you could argue, maybe a sometimes underserved character.
Yeah.
You and I are convinced that Serac Lofton's contract, it wasn't for like 26 episodes a season.
It must not have been.
Yeah. But sometimes a very underserved character. But I think the moment that he gets there, you read it all on Serac Lofton's face, though. I think that was maybe one of his best, like, just reaction shots there. Just him thinking about where his father is, how much he just yearns for his father's presence, knowing that he's got, like, a brother or sister coming along the way.
Sure.
He's also very close to Cassidy. We know that for a fact. So that's a tough moment to watch right there.
Well, you know, and it is him framed alone in that window. And then Kira comes and joins him.
Yeah.
So it isn't like he is left alone.
He has a support unit.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That he didn't have when the series started, where it was just him and Sisko coming to that station.
Well, think about it. I mean, we know that he's got Kira, Nog sticking around on Deep Space Nine as well.
Let's hope he's not transferred somewhere soon.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
You know, so I can picture that. And this is maybe kind of a tough fate for Jake, but I wonder if Jake is trapped on the station to a certain degree.
Well,
Jake doesn't want to leave until his father comes back.
Yes. I began to think as I was watching this episode, is Jake a tragic character?
I think he is.
Yeah.
You know, like we see his mother's death in the premiere, and then we have his father's demise in the finale. That's a tough thing to watch, especially for such a young character.
And Sisko never comes to visit him in the Celestial Temple. You know?
Yeah,
it's
like, no,
you
know,
Cassidy Yates is the one that gets the goodbye and everything. Jake never gets that farewell. And I know that was one of the biggest criticisms lobbed at this finale. It was very much loved by fans, but that was one of the biggest criticisms that the showrunners heard about, was people saying, like, look, you didn't give Jake a farewell with Sisko.
You know, I can understand that, but you know what? I think they tried to make up, or at least they're aware of that, and they made up for that with the fact that Jake has that departing shot where he's literally staring at his father in the Celestial Temple.
But when you look at all the other characters, they all are going on with their lives. They're going on to positive things for the most part. Whereas, like, Jake, you just get the sense, like,
well, we know
he's
from,
almost stranded at
we
the end.
Know from The Visitor that it's tough for him to kind of get that closure, you know, especially just his own parentage history. That's going to be a tough thing. And I think we both agree, like, for now, he's trapped on the station. And that's kind of a tragic end for that character.
It is.
Okay. Well, on that bright note, why don't we take another group of characters here and talk a little bit about how the series wraps up and where they can go. But I think that the most logical one would be the Worf, Ezri, Julian, and O'Brien relationships.
Right.
It was a fascinating I guess, discussion with Worf and Ezri when it's revealed that Ezri is pursuing a relationship with Julian, where Worf cracks his first joke of all time in Star Trek.
I will kill him.
Yes. Yeah. You know, and, it's like, and Jadzia never thought I had a sense of humor.
Yeah.
You know, that was a great moment.
Yes.
But do you buy the Ezri and Julian relationship in the finale? Because I got to watch the build up throughout the final chapter very recently.
Yeah.
Does it work for you? I mean, you did your rewatch very recently at Deep mm-hmm. Space Nine. Does it work for you in the finale?
It does. I could totally buy that Ezri would be attracted to Bashir. Like, their relationship, I think, totally works. I think the two actors have chemistry.
Yeah.
It's maybe a little faster than I would have liked, just because they only had the one season to work with Ezri, whereas you don't have sort of that grand sweeping dramatic kind of emotion
like
you have
Burnham and Ash Tyler.
Exactly. I really like salmon fishing.
Oh, yeah, no, it's trout
fishing.
Trout.
Yeah,
come
yeah.
on, man.
But I mean, no, you know, you look at, say, like the Odo Kira payoff, or
yeah.
even the Sisko and Cassidy stuff. Whereas, like, the Bashir and Ezri stuff, you're like, yeah, it's cute.
I feel like it's mostly going to be one of those kind of, you know, 8 month relationships where they realize,
wow.
well,
you're the pessimist on this.
No,
one.
I don't think this is a romance for the ages the way
yeah.
that the Jadzia and Worf or the Odo and Kira relationships were.
Right.
I mean, Kira and Odo didn't last forever, but to me, it's felt like a romance of the ages. The Ezri and Julian stuff feels more like, I think they'll get to the end of the relationship and realize they just feel more like friends than anything else. You
right.
know? And which, I mean, I don't think you need to have every single relationship to be like super, super deep, both in your life as well as in Star Trek. And mm-hmm. I'm okay with them, you know, going out for a year and then, you know, going from there and you know, pursuing their journeys through life.
Right. No, I mean, it does make sense. I would imagine if one was to delve into the non-canon Star Trek literature that they have been together in the long
they
haul.
They probably have like 14 kids.
Probably.
At this
that
yeah.
would be my guess. But no, I mean, I think the thing with Bashir, too, is that he always seemed flighty in relationships to a certain degree. Like, he
yeah.
was someone very much drawn to the excitement, and then he would kind of move on. I mean, this is a more mature Bashir after going through this war and everything. Maybe his priorities have changed, so maybe that's why I feel a little more optimistic. But it doesn't have that sort of punch that, like, say, Worf and Jadzia did, where you're like, these two are meant for each other.
Well, if we do want to speak to a couple that were meant for each other, let's also address the finale of the Julian Bashir and O'Brien relationship.
Yeah.
You know, where, like, to me, I was just cracking up throughout all of this.
Right.
With yeah, you know, just all the innuendo as well. Like, you could tell, like, Keiko is not impressed. Like,
yes.
like Keiko can't wait to go back to Earth and really, like, get, like, a husband who is actually dedicated to the family, not his stupid Alamo, like, scale model
yeah.
that he and his, like, best buddy are obsessed with.
How long would you be able to keep that Alamo mock-up in your living room before your girlfriend would be like, okay, that's enough?
She already lets us do the podcast once a
that's
week.
That's true.
I think I'm pushing it at that point. I'm not bringing any Alamo model in. I think I'm getting away with enough right
so I
now.
I guess we're keeping it my place.
Yeah, exactly. but also just the discussion where, you know, on the Defiant, yeah. as Bashir is, you know, helping O'Brien with his injuries, and O'Brien decides to break it to him that, you know, I've got to go back. And Bashir's actually kind of understanding. You can tell, you know, he it's time for him to move on. It's time for Bashir to kind of like expand his horizons. He knows
yeah.
he's going to have a friend for all time.
Right.
You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
They're not going to be able to hang out, play darts every day, but I think they'll be on subspace Skype going mm-hmm. forward and chit-chatting when, you know, they still can.
And I like that O'Brien is very like matter of fact about it. Like
yeah.
he's not a, you know, overly dramatic or emotional character. He's just kind of a little bit gruff, but you can tell in that montage where he holds up that little toy soldier, Cole Meany is just beaming at this soldier for an eternity.
Yeah, yeah. How many moments in that montage?
I do that a bit with my Vedic Braille figure every time the podcast ends and I go home.
Do you notice during the montage, there weren't too many moments of, say, Keiko and O'Brien together?
Yeah.
It was the Bashir and O'Brien stuff?
I mean, to be fair, I mean, the Keiko character was just a recurring one.
Yeah.
She was not a constant throughout the, you know, regular series episodes.
It'd
so
be great
I get
if
it.
The only montage moment was her in The Assignment, where
right,
she,
yeah, yeah.
she's occupied by the Pah race.
Right, you know? Yeah.
But I think at this point, O'Brien realizes, look, We're in like a war zone. I have a wife who's been back and forth between the station and Bajor. Mm-hmm. She's going back and forth between the station and Earth. I mean, I can't keep expecting this out of my family.
And
you
two
know?
Kids. Yeah, two young kids.
He's like, I got to buckle down. And it's, and I think you get the sense that maybe it wasn't always the happiest marriage between the two. But I think that they're in a very tough, stressful situation. And I think that their life on Earth is going to be a lot more pleasant for them.
Right. No, I mean, it totally makes sense, too, that this is the journey for O'Brien, because, again, he's not like a career officer. You know, it's like he was an enlisted man. So it makes sense that, yes, when an opportunity does open up to be, you know, back on Earth in stable circumstances where he can raise his family, I feel like that's where the character would go. I don't think that that's where, say, Riker would go. But it feels totally right for O'Brien.
I don't know what the fan fiction or the novels have to say, but do you...
I would imagine they bring him back for adventures and that sort of
thing. But do you think... I should rephrase that. I don't care what the fan fiction or the novels say, but I'm curious about your opinion here. I mean, is O'Brien essentially... This is the rest of his life. Like, I kind of get the sense that he doesn't need any more shipbound adventures or anything like that. Like, I think life... at Starfleet Academy is how he's going to retire.
Do you feel like he was a character who wanted adventures? Because he seemed more annoyed by them than anything.
He seemed like a guy who had a job to do.
Yeah.
He's there to do it.
And he's very, very good at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To me, and I think he's had enough adventures at this point. Like, he served on the flagship of the Federation when he was in Deep Space Nine. He fought against the Cardassians not once, but twice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get it. Like, he doesn't really need to do this anymore.
Yeah, I mean, after his really, really terrible war experiences and also that episode Hard Time.
Yeah.
And all those episodes that tortured O'Brien, like, I feel like, you know, he's a character who, I guess, takes the brunt of the abuse of these Starfleet stories a lot of the time. And so it makes sense.
I think that's Jeffrey Combs.
Well, that's also true. But, I mean, I feel like...
The Liquidator.
That's so bad. And yet so good. But anyways... you know, he's the character that just, it seems like they really pile how brutal some of these experiences can be on that character.
Yeah.
I think they affect him. And so I can totally see him being like, okay, I'm done. Like, let's go back home and, you know, live the quiet life. Whereas like a Riker, another character, and, you know, I'm sure do an episode of this at some point where he's a character who gets tortured a lot on the show too. But you always have the sense still Riker's reaching for the stars. You know, he's continuing to chase kind of that path that like Picard or a Kirk have been on.
The other character that we need to address here within this this character group is Worf. And ultimately him leaving Starfleet and becoming a diplomat.
I have a question about this.
Yes.
Now, what kind of communication is there between Deep Space Nine and like with Berman overseeing insurrection the following year? Is it literally like just do whatever you want and we'll deal with it?
No, it wasn't insurrection. It was insurrection aired December of season 7. So it was halfway through the final season of Deep Space Nine.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe the real question, and we'll get to it in a few minutes, and it's what we find out about Worf by the time we get to Nemesis.
Right.
Where he's back in Starfleet.
Sure. Okay, well...
Let's talk about what we do find out in Deep Space Nine.
I was going to say, that totally makes sense to me then. It's just like, end however we want, because we don't know when another movie's coming. I was thinking more that if the movie's coming up very shortly in development, if there would be more of a conversation about where to leave Worf, but that makes sense to me now.
Yeah, I mean, they knew that. I mean, the movie would be out before the finale.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, that all makes sense then.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like this for Worf, and that because we saw all throughout TNG, especially, he was a character who constantly wanted to reconnect with his Klingon roots, but felt like an outsider.
Yeah.
We see in Deep Space Nine, he becomes a little more differently, where he's very much tied to Klingon culture, and you know, is introduced to like Jadzia and all how she's tied to all that sort of thing. So we see he's become very comfortable over the course of Deep Space Nine with his Klingon heritage. So it makes complete sense to me that he's finally, after these two series, ready to transition into a life kind of among the Klingons.
And look, he's always had this family unit, mm-hmm. but it's one that he's neglected. I'm talking about kind of Alexander and then his family back home,
right.
And his Paul Sorvino brother.
Yeah.
Well, we'll forget about that for now.
For now.
Yeah. We're going to do an entire episode about that one. But after the death of Jadzia, like, I think it would have been sad for him not to be embraced by Martok's family. Like, he's part of the House of Martok. And I do like the moments, I forget if it's in the final chapter or if it's in the finale, but it's where Ezri finds out that she's considered part of House of Martok, too. And I think that's just such a wonderful moment because they're carrying on the legacy from Jadzia as well.
Right.
So for Martok to embrace Worf like that and say, look, I trust you. I'm going to have to navigate politics on Kronos. It's not going to be pretty. I'm a soldier, not a politician. Yeah. I'd argue that Worf's not a diplomat, and Worf argued that as well.
Yeah.
But I think this is this is an end to the character that makes sense, because we also know from the episode, season 6 of Deep Space Nine, I'm blanking on the name, but we find out that Worf saves Jadzia instead of this...
change of heart.
Was it change of heart?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Instead of like this diplomat that they needed to grab. And right. So Sisko said, you're probably not going to get a command because of this.
Yeah.
So it seems as if this should be Worf's fate.
Yeah, I really have always liked this as sort of the finale to Worf's journey in the Star Trek universe. That's why I kind of grumbled a lot when, you know, there was all these kind of rumors or talk about a Captain Worf spinoff. I was like, oh, to me, like, the ending of Deep Space Nine is so perfect, especially with Worf standing on the promenade, kind of looking around. And it is a sense of, like, he's kind of leaving all this behind.
Yeah.
And, like, Worf is embarking on a path that's very unique, because to me, he's such a unique character in the world of Star Trek. He's not a character who struck me as someone who's just like, yeah, I'm on to the next ship.
Well, okay, and... So I go back and forth on this. Like, what was a more meaningful assignment for Worf? Was it his time on the Enterprise, or was it his time on Deep Space Nine? Knowing, of course, that he did get married on Deep Space Nine. He found the love of his life there, and she was murdered there. Mm-hmm. I think it's time for him to move on from Deep Space Nine. But what do you think was a more meaningful adventure or meaningful assignment, I should say? Because I wonder if there's a certain prestige that goes along with being... on the Enterprise and serving under a captain like, say, a Picard, having, you know, kind of the A-team, where, let's be honest, it's a superhuman crew versus Deep Space Nine, which is populated by very flawed, very regular, far more interesting characters, in my opinion. But even still, like, it's kind of, I go back and forth about which time period Worf the character, not necessarily Michael Dorn the actor, but Worf
Dorn preferred Next Gen.
He had more fun, but he also got a lot more to do character on Deep Space Nine. He also made a lot more money on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
So where do you fall down on this? I'm kind of up in the air.
Yeah, I'm really up in the air. I feel like Worf is more nostalgic about the Enterprise crew. Like, I think the Enterprise experience really affected him at a very crucial ages. You know what I mean? Where he is... very much understanding who he is over the course of the 7 years on the Enterprise. It's not always portrayed particularly in an interesting way on TNG, and the character is often underserved on the show. But I do think you look at how he was changed the experience of going through, you know, and working under Picard and Riker and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like Deep Space Nine for Worf is more like a pressure cooker change, where it's like you get the marriage to Jadzia, but... if you remove that, was this an experience that he looks back on particularly fondly?
No, and I think it's because of the Jadzia death.
Yeah.
You know, and I think he could have pictured a life with her outside of Deep Space Nine, and he would have looked back more fondly on Deep Space Nine.
Mm-hmm.
But just that death has got to torture the guy.
Yeah, I was really bummed again seeing clips of it in the montage.
So my understanding of this, because I do recall this being controversial when it aired, and from what I understand is in the final chapter, there was the moment where Ezri walks into Worf's quarters that he shared with Jadzia, and she recalls hearing Jadzia's voice.
Right.
And apparently the issue was that Terry Farrell was never paid for any of that voice work. There's no clearances with her or anything like that. And I could be misremembering things, and I don't want to unfairly target Terry Farrell, who's, if you ever go to Star Trek convention, just one of the most lovely persons you'll ever encounter.
Yeah, definitely.
But I believe that maybe she or her agent had put up some resistance with regards to using clips of her in this montage.
I know Ira Stephen Bear, and I think an interview bit I read on Memory Alpha said it was the agent. He put the blame more on the agent.
Okay.
As putting up kind of these walls about using clips of Jadzia in that final montage.
I just wonder if it's tough when things are going back, and I have no doubt that at this point, Terry Farrell would be like 20 years later, like, we should have just had like clips. You know, it's just part of the legacy of the character.
And Ira Stephen Bear said it bothers him to this day.
I don't blame him for that.
It's really brutal because
the Blu-ray version that we'll never get, she'll
maybe
be in there.
Yeah, the re-edit.
Yeah.
The final cut. But I mean, when you have Worf on the promenade and you have this beautiful music, which, by the way, Dennis McCarthy just hits it out of the park with that combo version of The Way You Look Tonight.
Oh, I know.
With the Deep Space Nine theme. Oh, my God, that's brilliant stuff.
I'm so with you, Cam.
Yeah. But, I mean, just having Worf there, and then, you know, you want this montage to mean something, because the previous one we've seen was, do you remember?
Right before Worf?
Yeah. I think it's O'Brien, I believe, to the best of my memory.
O'Brien, I remember, was the first one, because he's the one that picks up the piece.
Okay, if he's first, then yeah, Worf follows him.
Okay.
And so, yeah, you have Worf then, and you've seen the emotion of that O'Brien one, which is so great. And then you get to Worf, and you're like, here we go.
He's hanging get upside ready. Down.
Yeah.
With Ezri.
In Strange Bedfellows.
Yeah. It's like, okay, that's one of the most iconic Worf moments of
and
the
then
series.
Killing Gowron.
Yeah.
And you're like, yep.
That was about two episodes ago.
Yeah. And so it does feel pretty clunky for a montage.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if maybe they just shouldn't have done one. If they couldn't get the clips.
Not
I
include Worf? I don't know.
Well, you still have him on the promenade with the music. I wonder if it drags you out of that moment. You cannot watch that montage and not be like, where's Jadzia? This doesn't make any sense.
I still think you need to give Worf his montage. I know it sucks, like, without Jadzia, but I still think... I think fans would have been angrier if Worf was just kind of excluded from his own montage.
Are there better moments they could have used?
Yes, absolutely, 100%. Yeah. So... let's touch upon it briefly before going back to Deep Space Nine, but we ultimately find out that Worf returns to Starfleet for Nemesis.
Yeah.
I felt that was such a huge betrayal of the character's fate.
Yeah.
And if I was any one of the writers from Deep Space Nine, I would be pretty dang pissed off that we find Worf not serving as a diplomat anymore, you know? And I think there was a recall during the development of Nemesis. I think in the script there's a line like Worf says, yeah, diplomacy was not for me. I'm
right.
glad they cut that out.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think it would have... Look, Worf was at the wedding for Riker and Troi.
Mm-hmm.
He could have easily been in, like, a diplomat uniform the whole time, or maybe he was there to do some diplomacy with Romulans or something. You could have had Worf not be in Starfleet. But would general audiences have been incredibly confused?
Sure, yeah. I mean,
I don't know.
I understand the hurdle there, because it's not like these... average fans or average, you know, attendees to the movie who don't necessarily follow anything to do with the show.
Well, Marina Sirtis would have been really confused too.
Yeah, no kidding. Like any of them have sat and watched Deep Space Nine.
I know.
So I get it. But I can't remember. It's been a long time since I've watched Nemesis, and because the last time was when we reviewed it on the show, so that was a couple years ago.
Yeah, you and I watched it together. That's the last time I watched
it. That was a couple years ago. Do you remember if there's any sort of acknowledgement as to why Worf's on the ship or anything?
No.
No, it's just like he's just there?
Yeah, well, I think it's because he's at the wedding.
Okay.
And then he just joins him on the ship when B4's head starts pinging.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's left kind of unspoken, I can still go along with it, I guess.
Unspoken in that, like...
they don't say he left being an ambassador. He's just back on the ship for some reason.
But no, but he's wearing his Starfleet uniform.
He just... saved it.
No, and I mean, to me, it means he left his diplomatic post. And
they were really in a hurdle, though, with that Nemesis movie, because Worf is a very recognizable, marketable character. And so they had to do something.
They could have given him a badass Klingon outfit to wear.
Sure.
You know, it would have worked. I know, I know what you're saying. You are correct. Like, I don't know what they would have done, but ultimately I feel betrayed by that fate for him.
I think one line of dialogue could have done it, though.
But what would the line have been?
Worf's here from an ambassador mission or something like that.
Right. Okay.
You have your chief of security gets killed, who's a random red shirt. Worf's here. Worf, can you help us out? Or something.
I know. But not to poo-poo that idea, but if you're a diplomat, you should not be like firing torpedoes.
He has experience, though. He has 7 years of experience on that ship.
I don't know if you remember this, but like the Canadian sergeant at arms who was the one that shot that shooter at Parliament to death. Do you remember this a couple years ago?
No.
So the sergeant at arms, former RCMP officer at Parliament here in Canada, there's a shooter comes into Parliament and he literally shoots the guy to death. And so he's granted a diplomatic post in Ireland. He's literally like the ambassador to Ireland. And then there's a protester. An Irish protester at some gathering, and this former cop starts like tackling the guy and like dragging him off. I'm like, buddy, you're not a cop anymore. You are a diplomat. You cannot get involved with this sort of stuff. He received a whole lot of criticism for that. And I feel as a Worf, he would face the same sort of criticism too.
I mean, I don't know if they'd criticize Worf that much, given that he's like killed many Klingon leaders.
That's very true.
It's like that's like a slap on the wrist for Worf.
Okay, so let's talk about maybe the next group of people here that I think are related, semi-related.
Oh, I have one Worf note I want to reference. Yeah. It's just him saying Minsk. Minsk.
A lot.
That was hilarious. That is maybe my favorite moment, at least comedic moment, in the finale. Yeah. I was dying of laughter.
I can't argue with that.
It's like the great comedy of repetition, like Sideshow Bob stepping on the rake. It just gets funnier the more times it happens.
For the What We Left Behind documentary, we should have one Michael Dorn stepping on rakes.
I would buy that for Worf.
Yeah.
Especially on TNG.
Yeah. So let's talk about Odo, Kira, and Quark,
right?
Who, you know, let's be honest, we've got to find a spot for Quark somewhere, and I actually think it makes most sense for him to be in the Kira Quark kind of dynamic.
Well, that's the emotional payoff to Quark in this story, is that him saying goodbye to Odo.
Yeah,
you know, Rom's already gone, so you don't have Quark sharing scenes with him, and Nog and Quark don't have scenes together, so.
But it 100% makes sense to me that the emotional payoff for Quark would be his goodbye to Odo, and 100% by that Odo doesn't want to say goodbye to anybody.
Yeah.
I love that, actually. It seems right. Kind of, and I don't think anybody would actually be offended by it.
Is Odo the greatest Star Trek introvert?
Like, who would be the main competition? I don't think he has much. Worf?
Yeah, Worf maybe runs a good second place, I think. I think a lot of people would actually put Worf maybe first.
And then Seven?
Yeah. You know what? Maybe Odo's got strong competition from a fan vote, but you know, Odo's maybe DS9's best.
Yeah, I'll take that.
Yeah, no, I absolutely love that. That he's just like trying to sneak out without anyone having that final moment. Like, I feel like people would be like tearing up and hugging Odo, and Odo would just be like crawling out of his skin.
I know, he would literally be shape shifting into like a bird that would fly off.
Yes, exactly. Like, that is not what Odo would want.
But essentially, I totally buy it when. You know, Kira says to Quark, I'm sorry, Quark. And Quark says, I can see it in his back. He does miss me.
Yeah.
I believe it. I honestly think that Odo does kind of miss Quark as an adversary.
I could see a different take on this scene of like kind of Odo doing a slight smirk or something. Like, that's the way I feel like that scene plays. Even though you don't have that smirk, it's like Odo, he knows what he's doing when he says that to Quark.
Yeah, I agree. But and I think maybe one of the most emotional payoffs throughout this episode, though, is the Kira Odo goodbye. Again, yeah. I think the room got a little dusty at this moment, Cam.
I mean, it works for all the same reasons you've seen in a lot of movies. Say, for example, like E.T.
Yeah.
It's just like, or Starman or something. Like, it's just like that beautiful farewell moment between, you know, like this sort of grounded character that's maybe a little more relatable to us just in terms of a human sense of like Kira saying goodbye to this very kind of otherworldly character. And it's just like all the emotions attached to that are just, most of this finale didn't, it works for me really well emotionally, but I don't think there's any bigger fireworks than this moment.
Well, just, I'll give you one that comes close in just a moment, but I just have to highlight the moment where we see Odo morph into the tuxedo and sink into the Great Link and then watch the Great Link be healed. There's just so many different layers going on here. And I think this might be kind of the emotional peak of the finale itself.
It is.
You know, it's so great. I totally feel for
that and Kaiwin going up in his puff of smoke.
Yes. A close second.
Yeah. You know.
So I totally buy just the sheer, we talked about Jake being a tragic character. I buy the tragedy of the Odo and Kira relationship.
Right.
And I buy the fact that the two can move on, even if Odo one day visits, you know, Deep Space Nine a few decades from now. I imagine them having like a very emotional reunion, but being able to move on from their relationship, you know, and having kind of a very collegial, you know, relationship moving forward. But there's just something special about this relationship that I didn't necessarily pick up on with regards to the future of the Ezri-Julian.
Sure,
You know, and I mean, I don't know. Like, I buy everything that happens within this.
And there is a real sense of tragedy to their relationship in that look how long it took them to kind of find each other.
Yeah.
You know, you had to get through Vedic Barile and Shakar and
The Cardassian occupation,
Oh, that little thing,
yeah.
You know, you had all these huge, sweeping, terrible events happening to them just politically. it was always kind of keeping them apart as characters. And that, yeah, ultimately this relationship was just like a brief, like a candle just went out. And it's like, this is the end with this story. And it's, to me, a very haunting relationship in Star Trek in that, you know, you can look at the Worf and Jadzia one as being very brief, but I feel like there's more of like, I guess, a closure to that one because death is such a finality. Whereas with the Odo one, it's like they just have to say goodbye.
Yeah.
You know, they're pulled in two different directions. And to me, that's just, I think, sadder to me.
For me, it's easy to picture where Odo goes from here. He spends a lot of time
in the Great Lake. I think it's pretty easy to tell.
Yeah. But what about Kira? Because ultimately, we see her in command of Deep Space Nine. And it got me thinking, like, look, it was fantastic seeing an Inquisitor in that Starfleet uniform. But I also wonder if, look, Bajor joins the Federation. I don't necessarily think that Bajoran militia members are going to get Starfleet commissions after that.
No, that's a good point.
And so I wonder how long her command of this space station really does last.
Well, I will have you know, Tyler.
I don't care, Cam, I don't care about fan fiction or the novels.
The novel Unity for those at home.
So,
Bajor joins.
Cam, you've been so good the last, I think, year and a half about not bringing up novels because I think you know just how much I hate it. Why are you bringing up for the finale of Deep Space Nine? Why are you torturing me with this, man?
Maybe it's because this finale has so many loose threads of where characters could go that it leaves you wondering.
I would rather use my own imagination than
you don't have to, Tyler. There's books.
Yeah, but I don't care about somebody else's like thoughts. Like I care about your thoughts and my
thoughts. I do it mostly to troll you.
But the thing is, for listeners, it genuinely irks me. Like Cam knows he is like getting under my skin by bringing up all this stupid like novel stuff that anyways
yes,
but I actually know what the novels have to say about her fate. She turns into a Vedic, and what?
Oh, is that true?
Yes. Okay. And I'm like, okay, I don't really like that as her fate, you know. Like, it, to me, I wanted her to be above, because I think honestly when it comes to the religious aspect of Bajor, I always associate it with like just very petty politics.
Sure. Yeah.
And I just don't see her being able to navigate around that. And I think it's ultimately kind of a lame sort of, you know, continuance of this character's journey. I'd rather, I don't know, like maybe, well, why not go visit Cardassian children refugee camps or something like that? What, like,
she could do that as a Vedic.
Sure. I don't know. But like, to me, I out of all the characters, I have the toughest time picturing what her future holds.
No, I agree with you. And the Vedic thing doesn't really work for me because, yeah, as you said, she's been there while like Barile's getting like hurled under the bus and, you know, not getting promoted to Kai and all that sort of stuff. Like, why would she want to take that journey as well when it seems largely arbitrary or driven through just manipulation? Like, you can't assume that there's not going to be another Kai Winn figure who's going to rise through the ranks.
And so I see her commanding Deep Space Nine for as long as she can, but I think ultimately she does move on. And I don't know, does she just simply return to a life as a farmer on Bajor? I don't, like,
does
I don't.
Does she just travel?
Yeah.
She just goes beyond. Like, is it tough to nail down that character? Because whereas a lot of them feel like they're going to move into organizational structures and Starfleet or the Klingon ambassador and all that sort of stuff, Kira's is much more open-ended as to she could go anywhere.
I feel like she has so much knowledge and experience that she just needs to share. Mm-hmm. But and which we saw with the Cardassian Resistance, but I don't necessarily need her to go teach other people how to make bombs or anything like that. I just wonder what's next for the character? And this is the one that I can't really figure out, which is why I'm very much looking forward to the What We Left Behind documentary, where they actually break down a hypothetical season 8 the writers do.
Yeah.
And so we'll get some hints as to what is in store, but I suspect she'll be commanding Deep Space Nine.
Well, we talked about O'Brien kind of being done and ready to just retire to a quiet life. How much is too much for Kira? Because you look at all she's gone through, how long before she's just like, okay, it's time to settle down.
Yeah, I think that's a very good
point. Because a lot of her old colleagues in the Rebellion did settle down to quiet lives before they were killed.
Yeah, I think they're all dead now.
Yeah. But, I mean, they had settled down to quiet lives.
Yeah.
You know, how much longer till Kira just decides to do the same thing? Bajor's in a good place right now. Why wouldn't she just want to maybe settle down in Bajor?
Yeah. Well, Okay. I maybe she can help build Ben that house before he returns.
In your mind, and this is not tied to any novels or anything like that, but more like the sense of, like, we never get the answer as to whether Bajor is going to join the Federation.
Yeah.
Could you get the sense that maybe that's going to be her achievement as a character, is to help broker that sort of creation of the relationship between the Federation and Bajor and bring them together, and that's kind of like her final kind of like career curtain call?
Well, then maybe I see her pursuing a life of diplomacy. Mm-hmm. Like, I could picture her being the Bajoran ambassador or representative on the Federation Council, you know, so to speak. Like, I think that would be a better, you know, kind of fate. And if she's brokering their entry into, mm-hmm. you know, the Federation, yeah, I really like that idea then.
And Kira's journey, so much of it was about her anger towards the Cardassians and all of that sort of the violence of her past. And she really does resolve that in this finale, you know, basically saving the Cardassians to a certain degree, but toppling the Dominion and all that sort of stuff. Like, I don't know that she has anywhere left to go in terms of that sort of
like her story. Journey. Yeah.
Like, I feel like that story's resolved. And so it's kind
as
of
is
like,
her relationship with Odo. So it's like,
so I almost look at maybe her guiding Bajor towards the Federation as being sort of the epilogue to her career.
Yeah, I like that. So let's talk about, I think maybe, if not the villains, but the more gray characters here on Deep Space Nine, but let's talk about the fates of Garak, Wayoon, Damar, and the female founder.
I think Wayoon's is pretty easy to sum up.
Yeah.
End of the road for Wayoon.
He's gone. Yeah. I have to say, when I saw that Damar's fate was getting shot in the chest and then his last words were keep.
Yeah.
I didn't really like it then.
Yeah.
And now I'm thinking, well, I don't know what else they really could have done with the character.
Sure.
In that, like, I think that what Cardassia needs is an entirely new start. Mm-hmm. Like, they need, okay, he dies the martyr.
Yeah.
They can venerate him as much as possible. You know, that works for me. And I think it actually makes a lot of sense. I think it would have actually been poisonous to have his presence continue on Cardassia.
Well, Damar was kind of a garbage person.
He was.
And so, I mean, give him that sort of redemption, I suppose, but you don't really want to see him stick around for the long haul.
I'll say this. I don't think anybody was happier with the final chapter and the finale than Casey Biggs. Like, that guy had so much to do, and he had probably the most prominent, like, character arc throughout.
Are you a fan of the way he goes out?
No.
Yeah, it's kind of lame.
It's lame, but I think ultimately he had to go out.
I agree.
You know, but I think there could have been a better way than just, like, phaser fire.
And he's, like, shot very quickly when they break into the compound.
I didn't even see it happen when it first aired. Like, I was just confused. I was like, wait, when did Damar get shot?
Yeah.
You know? And and then that kind of brings me to the next death that we can talk about. But Wayoon, it's just, I kind of dig that Garak just shoots him.
I like that it's Garak.
You know? Yeah. And this is actually a death that, as much as I like Wayoon, I'm just like, it's no more clones.
Yeah.
You know, even though I'd have to imagine that his genetic material is stored away in the Gamma Quadrant where he originates from.
Sure.
So I could picture Wayoon returning, you know, at some point. It works for me. Like, he was just such a little worm,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, he was, and I did love the fact that, we find out in the finale that, he really, really wanted to be the one administering Federation space.
Right,
and he was kind of annoyed that the Breen were going to be able to do that. At least that's what the founder was promising him.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm okay with how
I thought Wayoon it was a good end to that character.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't as great as Worf breaking, you know, the previous Wayoon's neck, but it was it was cool.
Okay, so before we get into, I think, the big one, Garak, let's talk about we did talk about the female founder.
Right.
It makes sense to me. She's, let me ask you this. After she orders the death of about 800 million Cardassians, how long is she going to be imprisoned for?
That was my question, too. I mean, how long can a founder live?
They've been around 10,000 years, right?
Yeah.
Or at least that's how long the Dominion's been around.
Sure.
So at least that long.
So how long could they imprison her for?
Well, okay, so here's what I kept going back and forth. Like, physically, indefinitely.
Yes.
But then that would constitute cruel and unusual punishment, which I don't think would follow with Federation principles.
Right.
So, but the thing is, what if the Cardassians or the Klingons had something to say about this?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, this seems like a very difficult proposition here.
like, I would understand more of what her fate was if they had to hand her over to the Cardassians or something. You'd be like, oh, I can guess how this ended.
Yeah.
Whereas with the Federation, I'm like, I really don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll have to go to Memory Beta, and I'll find out there.
But, I mean, I like that ultimately she turns herself in. But, boy, I was when I was watching this finale, I was like, is this, like, the most evil villain we've seen on Star Trek? He's pretty up there.
Yes. Yeah. Very capricious.
Because when you look at, you know, the Borg Queen, for example, who, you know, I think a lot of people would hold up as like a great villain, or Khan, they don't feel as like just ridiculously like overkill driven.
Yeah.
As the female changeling.
Do you think it's just the disease getting to her?
I think so.
Yeah.
She was like, if I'm going to go out, I'm going to take as many as I can possible.
But I wonder if it was even having an effect on her neurological capacity. Sure. You know,
I could believe that.
Yeah. So I'll take that.
Yeah.
Garak.
Mm-hmm.
This guy is the ultimate cockroach. Cockroach in that he just survives. And right. I think it would have been devastating and unfair to the character had he not survived through to the end of the finale. And
yeah.
I love the line that he gets, like, hey guys, it's official. My exile's over. this is the planet that I get to come home to and help rebuild.
Yeah.
I buy this. I think this is the perfect end for Garak.
Although there is an interesting question to be had, in that we talked about how Damar, there's no place for him in a new Cardassia. Is there a place for Garak, who has such a long history of shady dealings with Cardassia?
I think this is his only guarantee of being safe, because chances are everyone who is out to get him probably dead by now.
But is it better for Cardassia to move forward without people like Garak around?
Yes.
Yeah.
For Cardassia. But for Garak.
Yeah, well, for Garak, it works out great. Yeah.
But I also think that Garak has the opportunity. I don't want Garak to become the new spy master of Cardassia.
Sure.
I want him to pursue something of benevolence, or I don't know, or maybe a realization. Maybe he's the one working with Cardassian children, or I don't know.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I find him being kind of more of a guiding light because of his experience on Deep Space Nine, because of his experience with the Bajorans and the Federation, and saying like, hey, maybe I've seen how they can do it better, mm-hmm. and why don't I, you know, offer some input?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like Garak's fate.
You know? Yeah, it totally works for the character, and you know, he's such a great character. You almost just wish there was more of him in this finale, because he drives the best episodes. And I love the line he has to Bashir when he's saying goodbye. And Bashir's like, well, we'll see each other again. And he's like, maybe, but we live in uncertain times.
Yeah. Yeah. I buy that Garak never visits DS9 again.
Yeah.
I honestly do. You know,
do you think he sees Bashir again in your mind?
Yes.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's going to be this continuous, you know, back and forth between them.
Mm-hmm.
Although Stitch in Time, the novel from one Andrew J. Robinson, they do become pen pals. So there
now
you go.
This is Tyler.
This is Tyler
bringing this up.
Yeah, this is me bringing this up.
Yeah.
It's one of the few Star Trek novels that I really do enjoy. I feel that there's one more visit left in them,
mm-hmm.
and that's kind of it. I think the characters would just, their reason for interacting with each other kind of evaporates now.
And I like that Garak has that whole bit of dialogue about how Cardassia once produced like the greatest art and culture and all that, and it's all gone.
Yeah.
Which is very like pre-World War II Berlin. But, you know, it's that mourning for kind of the glory of what was there before things kind of turned for the darker, like they did on Cardassia. And I like that he's nostalgic for this, because it gives me some hope for the character that in his idea of a new Cardassia, they get back to that.
Yeah, not so much the military disposition, but the arts and sciences, which we heard about even from Gul Madred in Chain of Command.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I buy that. I buy that as the new Cardassia, especially it's going to be easy to do now that most of the military has been pretty much obliterated, the military resistance cells, and then much of the civilian population. I think people are ready to see this is what war brought on us.
Right.
This isn't the future for Cardassia. Dukat and Win, Cam.
Oh, okay.
How are you? I think we both agree that Dukat's character arc peaked with, say, Waltz.
Yeah.
Sacrifice of Angels could have been maybe a strong exit for him as well.
Definitely. Even, you know, when he was blinded and sent out just to be like
a beggar.
Yeah, on the streets. You know, that's a pretty mighty fall for that character. Like, there's multiple checkpoints along the road as to, boy, that would have been an amazing fate for Dukat.
Yeah.
I don't know that getting turned into, like, a gasping demon and then thrown in the fire pits where he just kind of goes to some sort of, like, Bajoran equivalent of hell. Is that interesting to me?
They did leave it open saying, like, he's in a place where he can't easily get out,
yeah.
Which means he could theoretically come back. I don't need to see Dukat ever again.
No.
Like, I love the character. I think we did an episode where we agreed that he's the all-time greatest Star Trek villain.
Yeah.
I don't need this character to be revisited, you know? Like, he's literally turned into, like, a magical being.
Dukat was a character who I think they exhausted by this finale, and he's the only one I would say that for.
Yeah.
I would even say, like, Kai Winn was holding up stronger. Like, it felt like her character was still going places that were new for that character that felt proper. Like, I don't think the Dukat stuff felt right to me, really, when he's, like, starting the Bajoran cult and all that sort of thing. It was like, now we're getting kind of weird. Whereas, like, Kai Winn, I believe it. Although I will say, they both featured in one of the more amusing scenes for me, which is actually kind of tied to that quote from Kai Winn I mentioned earlier about being the young woman waiting for her lover. But it's where she, like, rips off her, like, yellow robe, throws in the fire, and then just Dukat's, like, cackling maniacally. I just like the bizarre combination of these two sights. It was, like, so funny.
And watching them make out one last time, too.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah,
and then she poisons him.
Yeah.
What do you think about her getting the upper hand on him, at least theoretically?
Oh, I had fun watching that. Yeah. You know, like, because I think he should have kind of clued in that something was up, though.
He always seemed like a pretty crafty character. I was kind of surprised he got so easily duped.
Is he just so unbelievably egotistic that he could never wrap his head around this?
Maybe.
Yeah.
It could also be that, like, throughout the series, he was often a character who was wielding the power. Whereas we see in a lot of Season 7, well, at least once he links up with Kai Winn, she's the one with the power most of the time. She's the one who has the book, who has knowledge in terms of how the book works. And he's always kind of the guy going, like, how does this work? How are you going to make it happen? Like, he's kind of... She's the powerful one. He's the one who's kind of her lapdog.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that she's the one who gets the upper hand and poisons him.
All right, Cam. A couple other characters here. Admiral Ross... I know everyone's, dying to find out what we think about his fate. Admiral Ross, Martok, Nog, and Vic Fontaine. Admiral Ross, I mean, I think he just keeps being an admiral. Like, I'm sure he gets a promotion from vice admiral to full admiral.
He does this big moment where he gives a quote from General MacArthur.
Yeah.
From the, that was taken from Tokyo Bay after the end of World War II. How did you feel this was delivered? Like, did it have the gravitas that you would hope for?
I thought it was fine.
Yeah, that's the thing. It felt fine, right? Like, it's followed up by, like, a Sisko give me a speech to the whole crowd at Vix, and you're like, now that's a speech.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, the General Ross one, I was like, it's fine.
Yeah. What about Martok here? He returns to be Chancellor on Kronos. Makes sense to me.
That's cool.
Yeah. was it kind of a... an awkward moment where he wants to drink his big keg of blood wine with Ross and Sisko, and they just pour it out, you know?
I got a question for you.
Yeah.
If Sisko's not there, does General Ross drink the blood wine?
He's intimidated by Martok.
He's
drinking the blood wine.
Yeah.
But it had to take Sisko first to pour it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Vic. I alluded to it earlier, but I think one of the other big emotional moments here is when he starts crooning The Way You Look Tonight.
Right.
And then it's reprised later on during the montages with the musical score from McCarthy, Dennis McCarthy, that is. And I would have to say, like, this moment where he's just singing, like, I'm not usually big, like, Vegas, like, lounge tunes sort of guy.
Right. Except if it's Joe Piscopo at the convention.
Ladies.
Yeah.
This is my favorite Vic Fontaine sequence ever on Star Trek. Like, this one just had this emotional wallop, like, all throughout it. And I'm fine knowing that Vic's still over at Quark's, hanging out in the Hollow Suites, as his program continues to run, and Julian or Quark drop in and chill with him. You know, it makes sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, I love that sequence. It's just amazing. It's one of the greatest moments in a Star Trek finale ever. It might be the greatest. I mean, there's some amazing stuff in All Good Things, for sure.
Yeah.
But boy, oh boy, does this work like gangbusters as a scene that bids farewell to the characters.
And just kind of that hangout factor that I think draws both you and I towards Star Trek.
Deep Space Nine in particular.
Yeah. And it was nice to have this one last kind of hangout sequence. And yeah.
Yeah, and that's the final moment all the characters are together. And so it totally works.
Lastly, Nog. So I recall, first time I watched this, I just assumed that Nog had taken over Chief O'Brien's job, but then they didn't actually explicitly say it after he comes in and Kira comments on his promotion, one of Sisko's final acts as a Starfleet officer. Then I go look it up on Memory Alpha. Again, yeah, it's not stated that he is now in charge of operations like the chief was. So I think I had just made it up in my head that Nog is now, you know, kind of in charge of operations. It kind of made sense to me. But think about a character where they started in the series and where they end, where he's literally stealing Odo's buckets.
He didn't change a bit.
In episode one. And now he's like a junior grade lieutenant serving aboard Deep Space Nine, taking care of like cargo logistics. I think this is just a very meaningful, you know, way to dispatch like a character that could have just been like a forgotten about background sort of guy that was just Jake's troublesome friend for a few episodes.
And I like the moment too where he says that must have been one of the last things Sisko did was put in for Nog to get a promotion.
Like you feel like it means a lot to Nog that this guy vouched for him to get into Starfleet Academy and went so far as to vouch for him to get this guy a promotion, you know, like a permanent posting here in Starfleet. And I think it's a great journey for this character.
Yeah, it definitely pays off Nog well. I would have liked, and I know it's a packed finale, so there's not a lot of time, but, you know, if there'd been maybe like a Jake Nog scene or something, just
maybe
to kind of
in the montage
off.
As well.
Yeah,
you know, just like a couple clips of them.
Sure,
like hanging their legs hanging over the railings of the promenade, eating Jumja sticks.
Yeah,
that would have been nice.
Yeah, that would have been nice. But I mean, you know that when they're compacting all that Kai Winn Dukat stuff into like 3 minutes, that they are not going to be working in Nog footage.
I know.
You know, so
maybe a couple characters you suggested this, Cam, but maybe a couple characters we did not get to visit in the finale, and I don't know. Did you miss, let's say, Rom and Lita's presence?
I did. I mean, obviously there's nothing for them to be doing in this finale, but
Rom is now literally Grand Nagus back at Ferenginar. Like, he can't be on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think there could have been a way to just have him coming back to celebrate with Nog at the War's End or something like that.
Okay, yeah.
And just have them in that room with the Vic Fontaine scene would have been nice. But, I mean, it's not essential, but it does kind of... It feels wrong almost when you have that scene and those characters aren't there. But they aren't
But you know what? I would have thought it would have felt wrong if they were there because there's no reason for them to be there, though.
Yeah.
It just would have felt like sticking them in for the sake of it.
Right.
And they did have their closure in the previous episode.
It's true.
I'm okay with that. What about no Gowron, Cam?
Well, obviously.
What if we had a taxidermied version of Gowron hanging around during the signing of the accords, peace accords?
And Worf takes it with him when he transfers off the promenade. It's like slung over his shoulder.
Yeah, I'd have liked that.
Yeah,
you know? I don't know.
Shakar should have been in that final scene.
Another character we didn't get to see.
And Vic Fontaine should have been singing that whole song to him.
Cam, I still think that All Good Things is a stronger kind of one-off adventure.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, when it comes to emotional moments, there's just so many more, you know, 1-2 punches throughout this finale than there was for All Good Things, even though I think All Good Things is probably a better finale just because I think it encapsulates exactly what TNG was all about just within that, you know, 90 minutes.
Right.
I would say I have more criticisms of the Deep Space Nine finale, even though I think it's a great finale, and I think it's just a little bit too beholden to story beats that didn't always pan out so great. But as always, the strength of Deep Space Nine is character.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt as if they did good service to all the characters here, and that's what I really wanted more than anything else. And I love this finale so much. I easily put it directly after All Good Things when it comes to top finales.
Yeah, I agree.
And then Turnabout Intruder at number 3.
And then Counterclock Incident.
And then Counterclock. Yeah, that Robert April's wife, that moment tears in my eyes, Cam. Yeah.
Holding up her flower. I mean, when I think of the finale too, like, this is such an emotional payoff to the series. Like, I think All Good Things is a better story. Like, it's a really tightly constructed, incredibly smart and ambitious story.
Sci-fi.
Yeah, adventure. Sci-fi, high concept story that delivers, you know, the kind of the farewell you want from TNG, which is obviously a more episodic series. And also, they had the kind of the parachute of knowing they're going into movies.
Yeah.
So it's not farewell for them.
Okay, I'll say this. I felt as if when I watched All Good Things, the adventure on TV was over.
Definitely. Like, had there been no movies, it still would have been a great ending.
I feel when I watch What You Leave Behind, it's... they could have easily just come back for season 8.
Sure.
The adventure wasn't over for these characters, even though they went off and many of them did very different things outside of the station.
But you can understand why at the end of All Good Things, they didn't feel compelled to kind of underline where every character was going.
Exactly.
Whereas this to me feels like the really classic finale of saying farewell to all the characters. I think it does it incredibly well and incredibly emotionally. Even though I sit there and there's like problems I have with it and some of the storytelling, the thing just works like gangbusters because it carries you with the emotion of the entire series. And it's one of those finales, and I'm sure there's a lot of examples from the past, where when it's over, I'm like mourning that the show's over. You know, there's a lot of shows that go past their prime. I remember watching, like, for example, just random example, the X-Files finale. You're like, yeah, it was time to end it a couple seasons ago. This, you know, finale, whatever. But like
the Doggett Rhea's fate in the finale was one of the stupidest things I ever saw.
Yeah. Like it was like, yeah, okay, sure. Or even the Seinfeld finale, you're like, you know what, this show had been kind of going downhill. Whereas this one, I leave kind of, you know, when it ends, I'm still like mourning the fact I don't get to spend more time with these characters.
I know.
And that's the sign of a great finale, because if it just kind of petered out, you'd be like, eh, whatever.
So if I put you to the test, where does this one rank for you among Star Trek finales?
I think I would have to give All Good Things the edge.
Okay.
Because I just think across the board, it's firing on all cylinders. Whereas this one, you know, some of the writing's a little bit clunky.
Doesn't it almost seem like these are apples and oranges, though?
Yeah, they're two different types of finales.
So and maybe catch me on a different day, and I'd much prefer, you know, What You Leave Behind.
How would you have felt if they'd kept the original ending of What You Leave Behind, or the one that they had come up with? I shouldn't say original, but the one they'd come up with where the whole thing was like Benny Russell standing inside the film studios holding a script that said Deep Space Nine.
I totally agree with Rick Berman when he says, what does that mean for Star Trek Voyager or The Next Generation?
And the animated series.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, I heard Stephen Bear's response was, I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, I don't like the Benny Russell idea that Iris Stephen Bear had originally pitched. I'm glad that Berman, you know, clamped down on that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, no offense at all to Far Beyond the Stars, which is an amazing episode, but I feel like they got a little too attached to the Benny Russell character.
Yeah, yeah. But when it's coming back in like Image in the Sand and Shadows and Symbols, and I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Man.
So, no, I think that's one of the smartest things Rick Berman may have done, that he would then, you know, reverse all goodwill from with the finale of Enterprise.
Yeah.
But that's a story for another time. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. We had a ton of good chat last week about the best Voyager episodes, and we had some great feedback, and I love that people were throwing out episodes that were not mentioned by any of us.
Yeah, yeah.
Or by either of us. I mean, I think it was maybe Susan brought up Course Oblivion, which is a great episode. You know, there was...
You and I both like that one.
Yeah, I loved it a lot. Yeah. Yeah. And so there's so much discussion to be had about the best Voyager episodes.
And I think it also like reaffirmed our thesis about like it's very difficult for anybody to agree on like the best Voyager episodes, because I think everybody's kind of they like it for different reasons. But I like the fact that you and I did agree that, you know, maybe the best Voyager episode is Blink of an Eye.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And but you know, again, get me on a different day and maybe I'll make the argument for Counterpoint instead. So.
For sure. Okay, so what are we doing next week?
Cam, the short treks begin. These are the short adventures of the Star Trek Discovery crew. This first one out is going to be focused on one, I guess, Ensign Tilly now.
Yeah.
So we'll be doing a review of that. And
I have no idea what to make of these.
I don't know what to expect, which makes me even excited to even tackle this. But
these better be better than the one-shots that were on the Marvel Blu-rays.
I have no doubt they will be, because I thought those one-shots were some of the dumbest things and boring things ever.
There's a couple good ones.
I'll take your word for it. But yeah. I'm looking forward to this nonetheless. So we'll be doing full-out review on that. And we can have some fun with it and maybe kind of see where it's hinting at the future of season 2 of Discovery, or else, I don't know, it's a one-off adventure and we can just, you know, dissect it as its own thing.
Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Vic Fontaine, still singing in my heart, Smith.
And you can find me at Reportin. That's REPORTO as in Odo in the Great Link. That's going to make the best screensaver ever. N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.